From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, problems with how Texas tracks maternal mortality, more women are running for office in Texas, and another scandal with the state's Juvenile Justice Department. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. It's been widely reported that in Texas in recent years, there's been a dramatic spike in the number of women dying after childbirth as a consequence of pregnancy or childbirth. According to data collected by the state, the maternal mortality rate jumped 87% from 2011 to 2015. And as I said, that's according to the data. But what happens when that data is flawed? It's wrong. That's the finding of a new study. But how wrong is it? How did that noise slip into the signal? What can be done to fix this so the right information is collected and policymakers can correctly assess the magnitude of the problem and then deal with it? ProPublica has been covering the problems with Texas maternal mortality with their Lost Mothers series. I spoke with Robin Fields, managing editor of ProPublica.
A study has come out that looks at the numbers for Texas's maternal mortality rate, which is deaths that are considered maternal deaths that are related to pregnancy or childbirth. And previous research had shown that there was a fairly startling and dramatic spike in those rates starting around 2011. And I think that this study looks more in depth at the numbers comparing 2 5-year periods, one before that increase and one during and after. And what it finds is that while there certainly was a real increase in maternal mortality rates in Texas, there also appears to have been some data problems that have led to overreporting and probably an exaggeration of the extent of that increase.
So there's data problems, and we've known this from the very beginning, that we could not get good data. We could not get information broken down by counties about maternal mortality, and we couldn't figure out, like, what are the leading causes because everything has been so vague. And so this is just an indication that how bad is this information? How squishy is it?
The study that we were talking about doesn't really measure exactly how off the data is. It just looks at anomalies within it that tell us that it is off or suggest strongly that it is off. I think it all goes back to the reliance of the data. The data relies so heavily on death certificates. And death certificates, vital statistics, states since 2003 have added what's called a pregnancy checkbox on their standard death certificates. And what it does is it asks who the person filling it out to say whether the person who died was pregnant at the time of death or had been within a year of dying. And this is previous to the checkbox, a lot of maternal deaths were being missed entirely. So there was a fairly significant undercount. But the checkbox has not only sort of helped them capture those missing cases, it appears it's created the opposite problem, which is that some deaths that are not genuinely tied to pregnancy and childbirth are accidentally, through errors and things like that, being classified as if they were.
Texas doesn't require a medical examiner or a doctor to determine the cause of death in a death certificate. Texas allows justice of the peace to come up with these determinations. And only 13 of Texas' 254 counties enlist a full-time medical examiner to determine the cause of death when a person dies outside of a healthcare setting. So many times when we have a justice of the peace filling out the death certificate, these are elected officials. They're mainly law enforcement or lawyers, and they're not trained medical individuals. They're also subject to pressures of the community because frequently they're in rural settings. We've seen a vast undercounting of overdoses from the opioid epidemic in Texas. People say that could be due to the fact that it's the Justice of the Peace filling out the death certificate, and he does not want to list opioid as a cause of death because it might embarrass the family. And I'm wondering if that could be a factor here.
Certainly issues with, you know, problematic death investigations certainly could play into this, as well as the fact that autopsies, for example, are quite unusual in cases where it's not a suspicious death. Those are just atypical in sort of the U.S. system in a lot of states. It's not true everywhere, but it's true in many places.
So when we have this information now that there could be a problem, a statistical mirage caused by misreporting on death certificates, is there a concern that people may take that piece of information and use it to sort of dismiss the fact that, I mean, there is or is there isn't a problem of women dying in Texas after childbirth?
I think that this study, as well as, you know, pretty much every other report or study that's been done, suggests that there is a problem that is real, and that there's nothing in this study involving the data problems that would allow you to dismiss the genuine rise in maternal mortality that's gone on, not only in Texas, but in many places. I think that what the researchers, you know, on the study are suggesting that there be better data validation, more rigorous standards for that, ultimately will lead to greater clarity as opposed to dismissing this as an issue entirely. I also think that the Texas Maternal Mortality and Morbidity Task Force, the head of the task force has said straight out, look, you know, all the data problems aside, even when we get, you know, better data, we're going to find that the rates are too high.
We also know that the women who do die have maternal mortality. Many of them are women of color, and that this is something that particularly haunts the African-American community. Also, Texas has the highest rate of uninsured. We have a problem delivering prenatal care. There's a catalog of issues here. I guess we need to dedicate more resources in order to find out what exactly is going on.
Absolutely. I think that from vital statistics alone, you're not going to get the answers to all of those questions. But considering, you know, the rise in maternal mortality, getting answers probably has never been more urgent.
Robin Fields is the managing editor of ProPublica, a nonprofit newsroom that specializes in investigative journalism. 2018 is being called the year of the woman candidate. Dozens of Texas women are running for Congress this year. It's been 22 years since there's been a freshman female candidate elected to a full term in Congress, and a high number of women are running down ballot as well. Patsy Woods Martin is the executive director of Annie's List, a Texas organization that trains, recruits, and supports progressive women running for office.
We're seeing a couple of things. One, we are seeing a huge uptick in the number of women who have filed to run for the legislature, particularly in 2018 over 2016. I think there were in the ballpark of 75 who filed at this point in, I guess it would have been 2015, and well over 100, close to 110, who filed to run in 2018. So there is increased interest in not only taking action right now, but we at Annie's List in 2017 saw a huge uptick in the number of women who took part in our candidate workshops. What does it mean to run for office? How do you get started? How do you prepare? And we often see that, you know, women who participate in those workshops don't file immediately, but they file sometime in the future. So women are not only interested, but they are taking action on that interest.
And this is both major parties?
Well, the people who participate in our workshops are progressive women, but those who have filed for the House and Senate are of all parties.
Why do you think this is happening?
There are a couple of reasons. One, I think when we look around and see that someone like Donald Trump can be elected to the presidency, it tells us that anyone can be elected to public office. And two, at the same time, people look up and see someone with those the values that Donald Trump has and the impact that the right wing has had on women's issues, which are really family issues, has been devastating. And women are ready to stand up and say, I want to do something about it, and I can.
So have there been some issues of particular importance that women feel like they have to take a stand in? And I'm thinking about, and we're talking about this also in this week's Texas Matters program, the issue of maternal mortality in Texas. And that maybe the current administration in the state hasn't taken this issue seriously enough or dedicated the resources to actually get good data and find real solutions to make birth in Texas more safe.
Absolutely. And in fact, I mean, yes. One, a couple of things on that as well. One, we know the rate has climbed even with the data that they're using. At an alarming rate, and now there's question about how they're collecting data. And that all stems, I believe, and most people believe, from the far right wing's attack on women's access to health care and reproductive health care particularly.
Right. I can see that how people might think that, but right now we don't know that for sure because we don't have the data.
You're right. We don't know that for sure, but it does make sense.
To some people, yes. But that's why we have to do the science. And this is why...
I'm a chemist, so I believe in data 100%.
How about the Me Too movement? And I don't like calling it that because it seems so, you know, trifling to call it the Me Too movement. But people, women standing up and saying we will no longer be, you know, objectified in our workplaces and or even preyed upon in the workplace. And so is that part of this?
You know, I think women having the courage to stand up and say that sexual harassment goes on. It is pervasive in any situation where you have men in power over women. And for a few women who have experienced that, to stand up and say it is not okay, hopefully encourages others to stand up as well. And I believe if women stand up and if perpetrators of sexual harassment suffer consequences while the women who stand up don't suffer consequences for actually calling that out, we will see a shift. And obviously when we have more women serving in positions of power, that should go down as well.
That seemed like an assumption that it's, you know, it can be debated. There are women who feel all sorts of attitudes and beliefs. You know, are they really all lockstep in one way of addressing issues?
Oh, they're not all lockstep. No, but we know that that women, whatever their values are, work across the aisle. They work together. They work to come to good resolution of issues. And so, do I think that all women think exactly alike? No. But I do think research shows that when women serve in elected office, they reach across the aisle, they work with other people in order to get to a good conclusion for their constituencies.
Do you think having more women on the ballot will bring more voters to the polls?
I hope so. But I don't know that that's been proven to be, be an accurate statement.
Do you think women want to vote for women?
No, I don't think that's an assumption you can make. I think women want to vote for women who talk about the issues that are important to them.
Do you think there were obstacles keeping women from running for office and either the pressure has built up to such a point where people are overcoming, blowing through those obstacles, or those obstacles have fallen away?
Oh, I don't think the obstacles have fallen away. I think the climate has become, the political climate has become so toxic, and the consequences for women have been brought to the forefront. And we as women are in a position and are ready to stand up and say, enough. We can make a difference. We see that anyone can get elected, and we're going to go for it.
I mean, we had a Texas female governor. We had a Texas female senator. No longer. Did something change?
I think what's changed has been an awareness and a willingness to stand up and take action. In my own experience, so I grew up in the 60s and early 70s, and I saw women a little bit older than I fight really hard for women's rights, if you will, for the right to have a checking account in your own name, the right to have jobs that were typically in the male realm. And I knew I was the beneficiary of that. I majored in chemistry and went to work on the ship channel, for God's sake. And I was the only woman there, right? But I knew that there were women ahead of me who had fought for that. And then I raised two daughters who looked around and saw that every class in their colleges were the majority female. And, you know, majority of the students in law school and medical school now are female. And I did not instill in them and help them understand the battles that had been fought so that they could sit in those classes. And now, with women's reproductive rights under assault, with people, you know, not taking equal pay seriously for women, suddenly I'm seeing a new awareness that reminds me of what I saw in the 60s. And because, you know, since the 60s, we've had a few more women elected to office, seeing even more and more stand up and say, what's going on isn't right. I can change this by serving in public office.
Do you think we're in a revolution like we had in the 60s?
I think we could be. I hope we are. Because I think we saw some changes as a consequence of that.
Patsy Woods Martin is the executive director of Annie's List, a Texas organization that trains, recruits, and supports progressive women running for office. A coalition is calling for sweeping reforms to the Texas juvenile justice system after a new scandal has been uncovered in a state juvenile lockup facility. This is the third time in 10 years there's been a crisis at the Texas Juvenile Justice Department, according to these watchdogs. They advocate for the reduction in large-scale prison-like facilities in remote locations in Texas, and they want the expansion of smaller, closer-to-home programs that provide greater results for rehabilitation. Lauren Rose is the director of Youth Justice Policy at Texans Care for Children.
In the headlines right now are... is a scandal, and it's particularly at the Gainesville State School. A number of staff in the facility have been arrested and prosecuted for sexual misconduct with youth, which is obviously very concerning. And you're correct, this headline comes about every few years. 10 years was the last big scandal, but, you know, we hear every few years about staff encouraging youth to fight one another. And, you know, when it makes the headlines is not always when it's happening. You know, I think what we're proving is that this is a persistent problem in our state secure facilities, that children are having their basic civil rights violations, that they're not safe, that they're not being rehabilitated. And what we've proven is that this model of large, remote facilities with way too many youth is not an effective model, and we need to be closing down those facilities and moving kids closer to their home where we know that rehabilitation is more successful.
So the Dallas Morning News broke the story about what's happening in Gainesville. Their reporting tells us that sexual abuse is rampant in Gainesville. They reported last in November that youth offenders attacked guards. They claimed that the staff paid them to fight each other. And at least in one case, a psychologist on the campus gave pornography to a boy and encouraged him to use the pornography in front of him. So at the very least, we need to know more of what's going on.
Absolutely. And I appreciate the governor's response to this. He has sent in Texas Rangers to investigate, to get further, find out if there are other issues that have not yet been reported. And I think that's a great first step. You know, there's broad consensus that when youth steal a car, commit an assault, other sometimes serious mistakes, that they, one, need to be held accountable, two, they need to be kept safe, and three, they need supportive therapies to put them on a path to success. And what we're seeing in this news is that these large remote facilities are not effective in doing any of that. And so it's time to investigate, get down to these problems, but we need to start planning on shutting down these facilities and moving kids to where they can be set, they can be safe and get the support that they need to go on to be productive citizens.
My concern is when we say, okay, I'm calling out the Texas Rangers and they're going to do an investigation, is that there's zero transparency in what goes on. And when we know that this is an ongoing problem, it happens decade after decade, a new eruption, isn't it time that we would have a full, transparent investigation, hearings in Capitol, in Austin, with more participation and visibility about what is really going on?
I'm always supportive of transparency, and we definitely want to know everything that is uncovered by the Rangers and understand everything that is happening in these facilities, and would completely support having those open discussions because we need to have all of the facts to start addressing these issues and making sure that all youth are kept safe first and foremost.
Another problem that's coming up with these facilities is the staff shortages. They're telling us they cannot find experienced staff for the state's five juvenile lockups.
And I think that's part of the concerns in terms of this model. We have these large facilities, sometimes 250-plus kids in those facilities out in remote areas. They have to be staffed around the clock, and when you have... when you need that many youth in remote areas, you know, the staffing is going to be difficult, and that's part of the reason why this model, like no budget fix can happen to make these facilities work and effective. You know, new leadership in the facilities or at the agency is not going to make these facilities effective. Moving them out of rural areas and making them smaller is what's going to make an effective juvenile justice system.
Now, juvenile justice follows trends. We've saw that the during the 70s, they had that super predators, I don't know what you call it, the trend.
Scare.
And so we had an explosion of our population in our juvenile justice system. And then we have seen in the last 10 years a great reduction in the number of juveniles held in these centers and in these facilities. Because of success with closer to home, trying to have programs that are nearer to the families of these individuals, and we're seeing better results with rehabilitation. From what I understand from speaking to officials, is that they're saying, well, these are the worst of the worst that we now have in this system, and these are the ones that need to be locked up, and they cannot be allowed to participate in closer to home because they won't participate. They'll run off.
Well, the concept of worst of the worst is a misnomer. Comparisons have been done of the kids who have been put in state facilities versus kids who are kept locally, still potentially in facilities, but not necessarily locked up at these five facilities. And they're really no different. And so, you know, research has been done comparing youth who are similar at the state facilities versus similar to county-run probation facilities. And youth held in the state facilities that have similar backgrounds, similar offense histories, are 21% more likely to reoffend when they leave those facilities. And when they do reoffend, three times more likely to commit a felony. So we know that we can hold these youth closer to home, in their home communities or near their home communities, and they're less likely to come out reoffending, right? So we're keeping them safer, and we're keeping our improving public safety by reducing the likelihood that they reoffend. But to be clear, there is no worst of the worst. It's kind of who got the short end of the stick and got sent to a state facility.
Well, it can be which counties have facilities and which ones don't. You know, there are counties that have resources, and then there are rural counties that have few resources. They don't have the ability to do closer to home, and so they opt to send their juvenile offenders into the state lockup.
Right, right. So there's work that needs to be done at the local level to ensure that the resources are available, whether it's community supports with the youth at home, whether it's making sure that the probation department facilities that we're using now are being used effectively. You know, if there's kids in facilities that don't pose a risk, they shouldn't be in those facilities and make space for the kids that are sent to state facilities. So we need to look at the resource allocation and making sure that we're putting the resources where rehabilitation is most effective, but also looking at who do we put into the juvenile justice system. You know, more than 30% of the kids in the system come in for misbehavior at school that when I was in school would have been addressed in the classroom. So those kids, we should be looking at moving them out of the juvenile justice system to create and shore up more capacity and better use the resources that are available for the juvenile justice system for kids who have more serious treatment needs.
What are some things that you say, some specifics, benign things that happen in the classroom that send kids to these lockups?
You know, I mean, I think looking at some schoolyard fights, you know, I talked to local officials that get kids who flicked the kid at the next desk with a pencil, and they're sent to probation for assault. You know, we need to be looking at what is really a criminal offense. Because flicking a kid with a pencil is not, you know, not something that a kid, we need to be using juvenile justice resources on. So making sure that we are not kind of upping the charges to get kids out of the classroom. You know, I think schoolyard fights can be addressed in schools, at least most of the time. They don't need to be going into probation.
But do you think that there might be some juveniles who need to be in secure facilities?
We are not calling to close secure facilities. We are calling to look at the model that we have today and make it effective. So when we're saying close the state facilities, we're saying find appropriate places to put these youth, whether it be keeping them in the local probation post-adjudication facilities, which is a secure confinement, treatment centers that can provide them the treatment that they need, which many youth in the justice system are in treatment centers and not in state secure facilities. Potentially, we need to look at building a handful of small secure facilities near urban centers where the kids are coming from and where highly trained staff are available.
Lauren Rose is the Director of Youth Justice Policy at Texans Care for Children, which along with the ACLU, Texas Appleseed, and the Texas Criminal Justice Coalition is calling for sweeping reforms to the Texas juvenile justice system. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. Or you can comment on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to, and you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.